Chapter 63. I didn't go back to the hotel. I left directly from the sheriff's department, with nothing except cash in one pocket and the Beretta in the other. We saw no passing traffic, no big surprise. It was the dead of night, and we were far from anywhere. Pellegrino didn't talk. He was mute with fatigue, or resentment, or something. He just drove. He used the same route I had come in on, first the straight shot east-west road through the forest, and then the minor road I had ridden in the old Chevy truck, and then the dusty two-lane I had ridden in the sagging Buick sedan. We crossed the state line into Tennessee and passed by Germantown, where I had gotten out of the lumber guy's pickup, and then we headed through the sleeping southeast suburb and arrived in downtown Memphis, still well before dawn. I got out at the bus depot, and Pellegrino drove away without a word. He went around a block, and I heard his motor beating between buildings, and then it faded to nothing, and he was gone. The early start gave me a big choice of buses, but the first of them didn't leave for an hour. So I quartered the surrounding low-rent blocks, looking for an all-night diner, and I found a choice of two. I picked the same place I had used for lunch 3 days previously. It was cheap, and it hadn't killed me. I got coffee from a crusted pot, and bacon and eggs from pans that had been hot since the Nixon administration. 50 minutes later, I was in the back of a bus, heading north and east. I watched the sun come up through the window on my right, and then I slept for the rest of the six-hour ride. I got out at the same place I had gotten in 3 days before, at the depot on the edge of the town, close to the post where I was based. The town bore no obvious similarity to Carter Crossing, but all the same elements were there. Bars, loan offices, auto parts, gun shops, used stereo stores, each one of them thriving on the supportive stream of Uncle Sam's military dollars. I walked past the mall and headed into open country, stopping at the diner half a mile out for lunch, then continuing onward. I was back on post and in my quarters before 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which was much earlier than I had expected, and which gave me the chance to improve my plan a little. The first thing I did was take a long hot shower. Devereaux's scent came up at me in the steam. I dried off and dressed in full-on Class A uniform, soup to nuts. Then I called Stan Lowry and asked him for a ride back to the bus depot. I figured if I hurried, I could get to D.C. by dinner time, which was about 12 hours ahead of schedule. And I told Lowry to make no secret of where I was going. I figured the more people who knew, and the longer I was there, the better chance things would have to come crawling out of the woodwork. Washington, D.C., at 7 o'clock on a Monday evening, was going quiet. A company town, where the company was America, and where work never really stopped, but where it moved into quiet, confidential locations after 5 in the afternoon. Salons, bars, fancy restaurants, townhouse parlors. Those locations were unknown to me, but I knew the neighborhoods most likely to contain them. So I skipped the kind of distant chain hotels a lowly old four like me would normally use, and I headed for the brighter lights and the cleaner streets and the higher prices south of DuPont Circle. Not that I was intending to pay for anything. Legend had it, there was a fancy place on Connecticut Avenue with a glitch in its back office, whereby uniformed guests were automatically billed to the Department of the Army. Some one-time conference arrangement that had never been canceled, or some embittered veteran in charge of the ledgers, no one knew. But the legend said you could be in Arlington Cemetery before the charges caught up with you. I walked there slowly, in the center of every sidewalk I used. I was vigilant without appearing to be so. I used store windows as mirrors and gazed around innocently at every crosswalk light. No one was paying me any attention. I was crowded and jostled at times, but only by normal, busy people rushing ahead to the next thing on their long agendas. I got to the hotel without any trouble and checked in under my real name and rank, and the legend held up in that I was asked for no charge card or deposit. All I had to do was sign a piece of paper, which I did, as clearly and legibly as possible. No point in being the bait in a trap and then hiding your light under a bushel. Not that I had ever been sure what the bushel was. Some kind of a small barrel, I assumed, in which case the light would go out anyway for want of oxygen. I rode the elevator to my room and hung my Class A coat on a hanger and called down and asked for dinner to be delivered. 30 minutes later, I was eating a sirloin steak, which would also be billed to the Pentagon. 30 minutes after that, I left the tray in the corridor and went out for a walk, just trawling, just seeing if my passage would pull anyone out of the shadows behind me. But no one reacted, and no one followed. I walked around the circle and then quartered the blocks beyond it, passing the Iraqi embassy at one extreme and the Colombian at the other. I saw men and women I took to be federal agents of various kinds, and men and women out of uniform but clearly military, and men and women in uniform from all four branches of the service, and numerous private citizens in serious suits, but none of them made a move against me. None of them was even slightly interested. I was part of the furniture. So I went back to the hotel, and I went to bed in my luxurious room, and I waited to see what would happen the next day, which would be Tuesday, the 11th of March, 1997.